Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Life is no picnic for China's millions and millions of migrant factory workers. 13-hour shifts, crowded dorm rooms, meager pay. But the giant factories that make your sneakers and alarm clocks and fancy bags are also, in their way, churning out hope and opportunity. It's a place where a girl from the village with guts, ambition, and luck can work her way up from assembly line drone. In a new book, reporter Leslie T. Chang tells these migrant workers' story like never before. This hour on Point, China's factory girls. You can join the conversation. Who do you picture on the other side of your sneakers? The girl on the factory floor. Might she look you straight in the eye one day soon? We go first to Beijing today for a check-in on how China is seeing the global economic crisis right now. Joining me is Anthony Kuhn, NPR's Beijing correspondent. Anthony, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be with you, Tom.
First, I mean, we've seen the blood on the market, the trading floors all over the world. What is the economic response in China in the markets there and beyond?
Well, the truth is that China's stock markets this year are the world's worst performing. They've lost 70% of their value since their peak about a year ago. And so the good news there is that the bubble is deflated. And that's terrible news for China's roughly probably about 100 million stockholders. Now, that's a very small percentage of Chinese total. But a lot of people have lost their shirts, and a lot of people have just been staggered by the collapse of what they thought were pillars of the international economy, the Wall Street firms that have collapsed or been bought out. So the response is one of shock. But it's a very different situation than China is in than in Western countries. Their stock market and their financial system is not as well developed in the West. And as the crash of their stock market has shown, it was very it was not really very well tied to the economy as a whole. Now, on the positive side, this is the world's fastest growing economy. They've got the world's biggest stash of foreign exchange reserves. They got $1.8 trillion, a lot of it in U.S. Treasury bonds. And they have the world's highest household savings rate. But now the problem is when Americans and Japanese and Europeans start buying fewer iPods, fewer Nike sneakers, less patio furniture, what is going to happen to these factory girls?
Anthony,
decline.
Let's look at the bubble for just a moment. What made up China's bubble? I mean, the U.S. has had a housing situation that has come unraveled. What was the bubble in China? Was it just an overshoot on the stock values there, or was it related to property, to something else? What was their bubble inflated with?
Well, there was another property bubble. But the stock market has just been insane. In the past couple of years, it doubled in value twice since about 2006. And people just thought all that could happen was that it would go up and, hundreds of thousands of people opened accounts. Everyone started piling in with all their household savings.
Up and up it went.
Up and up it went. It had nothing to do with the real economy. Had very little to do with corporate performance. There was very little way to tell, what the fundamentals were, and people were really betting on what the government would do. And everyone assumed that with the Olympics coming this year, the government would step in and stop it from crashing, and they didn't. And that suggests that they have learned a lesson about not intervening, not fiddling too much with the markets.
What kind of lesson?
In a way, that's a good lesson.
Yes. What kind of lesson does it appear Beijing is taking from the crash of markets elsewhere? I mean, they've put so much money into the United States just for starters. They may have a lot of reserves, but the demands now from the U.S. for more liquidity are so big, with $700 and $800 billion bailouts and rescues being discussed, even for China with its $1.8 trillion in reserves, $800 billion is a lot of money. Is China still there for the United States as a source of investment, liquidity, capital, or are they thinking twice about that?
Well, I think like a lot of countries, they're feeling a bit burned. The U.S. sold them a lot of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds, Ginnie Mae bonds. They started developing their own mortgage-backed securities and fancy financial derivatives. They're now taking a second look at that. And I think they're going to be a lot more cautious in how they look at financial risk. But they are still very much closely linked to the U.S. A lot of export firms have started to close down, but still, you know, they make so many of the things we in the U.S. buy. But now this whole export model is, you know, exports account for 40% of China's economic output. And if that is in question, if global demand drops and these factory girls start being thrown out of work, that is a very dangerous challenge facing China's economy.
And is China prepared to act in concert with other major powers around the world? Lots of talk about international action now. Are they prepared to sit down and join that, or are they going to, you know, chart their own way through this crisis, Anthony?
Well, I think it's been a little bit naive and unrealistic for some people to expect that China would rush in with this $1.8 trillion of foreign exchange reserves and start buying up Wall Street firms that are failing. Japan has spent a little bit of money on that, but they have a lot more experience than China. China has just gotten into the business of investing. For example, they bought banks bought shares in Barclays of Britain, in the private equity firm Blackstone, and also in Morgan Stanley, and those investments have done terribly. Most of those have lost half of their value because they were all exposed to mortgage-backed securities and subprime loans. And so now they're going to be very cautious about stepping in investing in U.S. assets. But in the long term, they've got all this money to spend. The banks have all this money and household savings that is sitting idle. And so they do want to buy American assets. They do want to have their firms expand into the U.S. market. There's no question about that. But right now, they're going to be very cautious about it.
Cautious, but in the long term, no way to avoid a Chinese role. And, of course, the implications as well, as you say, for recession globally on the factory girls we're going to be talking about in this hour. Anthony Kuhn, NPR correspondent in Beijing. It's great to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us, Anthony.
Thank you, Tom.
Joining me now from San Francisco is Leslie T. Chang. She spent a decade in China reporting for The Wall Street Journal. Her new book out this week is Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Simon Winchester says it rises head and shoulders above almost all other new books about China. He says, calls it the first long, hard look we have ever taken at the people who are due to become before very much longer the new masters of the world. Leslie Chang, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're looking at factory girls, and you've gone deep on it. There's a kind of stereotypical image out there in the world. I mean, we've heard about China's big factories for a long time and the fact that 70-80% of the workers in them are female. What's the stereotype out there that you've almost written your book in opposition to, Leslie? What did you find people imagining before you went so deep into the real lives of factory girls?
That's right. That was kind of my starting point for this project. You know, I was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Beijing for a number of years, and I noticed that foreign newspapers, including my own paper, had written stories about the situations inside Chinese factories. And these generally focused on the worst cases, you know, the abuses, the miseries, the terrible bosses, workers who'd been injured or fired or went home in shame. And I sort of became curious about what migration might look like from the migrant's own point of view. You know, what is it like to be a young woman, 17, 16 or 17 years old, to come out from a small farming village to a big city, to learn how to find a job, make new friends, live among strangers, even date or, you know, possibly get married to someone they meet in the city. So I wanted to sort of chart the emotional experience for someone coming from rural China, which is something that I felt like people had not really heard about before.
This is an emotional experience shared at this point by millions and millions and millions of Chinese. There's even a phrase for it, going out. And it means going out of the countryside village with everything that that means, the poverty, the kind of insularity. Give us a sense of how big a step it is for a young woman, and in your case, I mean, they can be very young, 15, 16, 17 years old, going out from their village.
That's right. These young women usually go out when they don't test into the next level of education, which for most of them is probably middle school. the more privileged might have a little bit of high school education as well. So as you say, you know, they're 16 or 17, they've never been away from home, and suddenly they're in the city of 5 million. You know, Chinese cities are very large, so it's 5 million or 10 million or however many million people, none of whom they know. You know, it's a complete shock going from a village where you know everyone, or a small school in the town where you've known everyone and you're probably related to many of the people, suddenly to a giant colony of strangers. So, you know, most of the migrant women I spoke with, when they talked about their early journey to the city, my feeling was that, you know, it was almost a traumatic experience, and there were many things that were blurred and that they didn't understand, and they could barely recall about those early days in the city, I think, just because the shock of the arrival was so great.
And yet, at the same time, you write that they are, and very consciously, headed out on an adventure that in a way parallels China's huge coming out into the world these days. I mean, when they go out from their village, they are becoming part of an enormous economic ascent that will include one way or another, to one degree or another, their own.
That's true. And yeah, I did find that's a very nice way of putting it. I felt like the experience that China is going through in these, you know, couple of decades, this embrace of the world, this figuring out what its role in the world is internalized in the lives of many of these migrants. And when they talk about their move to the city, they also talk about, you know, integrating with the world, becoming modern. You know, they see their individual project as in quite large, dramatic terms. That was one of the things that I found really interesting because, you know, as you know, in the past in China, Confucianism was a very powerful force which really focuses on the family, the group, the hierarchy.
And they become independent players.
Communism, which,
hold the thought, Leslie. We have to take a short break here. We'll be right back with Factory Girls and Leslie Chang. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the women behind the clothes on your back and most everything we buy, the factory girls of China, and how they see the world. My guest joining us from San Francisco is Leslie T. Chang. She spent a decade in China reporting for the Wall Street Journal, spent several years doing the footwork that she pulled together in the book coming out this week, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It's a remarkable, remarkable story. Leslie, you end up focused on two young women in particular. I wish you'd give us a bit of an introduction to them, where they came from, why they left their villages, and what they found when they moved out.
Yeah, I basically focused the book around two young women. One's name, I call her Min in the book. Mm-hmm. She was 18 years old when I met her. And the other, Chun Ming, was about 31, and she had been in the city already for a decade when I met her. I specifically wanted to, you know, find a couple of women in different age groups to see their experiences and compare them. Both were quite representative in that they came from rural villages of poor families with very little education. They themselves had probably had had a middle school and a little bit of vocational high school education. Mm-hmm. So pretty standard for the vast population of migrant workers in China. But the reason I chose to focus on them was they both were quite lively and talkative and curious about the world enough to want to talk to me. And I realized that this was kind of the main challenge in reporting in a place like Dongguan, the South China factory city where I did my reporting, was that people are so mobile. If they don't have some incentive to stay in touch with you, you're going to lose them. There are many young women I met on the streets who seemed very friendly and interested in talking to me and gave me a phone number. And then I would call it a few weeks later and they had already left the factory. And I just, you know, I lost touch with untold numbers of people that way.
We've talked with James Fallows on this show in other times about exactly that mobility. Whole factories moving, that without a kind of GPS tracking where factories and companies and you name it are, they can just be gone the next time you look. The city that you look at, Dongguan, this is up the Pearl River from Hong Kong, 30 miles from Guangzhou. Incredible scale of factory worker population. Just paint a bit of a picture of this. This is just one. It's a very big one, but just one of these factory cities in China. Give us a sense of it, Leslie.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it was like when I first went down there. You know, I'd sort of decided in the abstract that Dongguan might be an interesting place to report about. So I just sort of went down there and walked around the streets, and it was just overwhelming. I mean, first, just the sheer mass of people. You know, when you're standing in the factory zones at 6 o'clock, when the workers all get off for their dinner break, it's just like multitudes of people. And then you notice that they're all basically teenagers. You know, they're all between the ages of 16, 17 and, you know, mid-20s. So it's kind of got this feeling of this, you know, big, you know, open air high school or college campus, you know, except all the workers are wearing factory uniforms. You almost never see an older person around.
And the official numbers say 1.7 million population, that with 7 million migrants, 70% of them female. It's hard for Americans, I think, these days to picture a factory worker population of that size sort of grafted on to a core population of any city.
Yeah. It is kind of interesting because I'd reported in Dongguan for months and months, and I never actually met a Dongguan resident. You know, everyone I met was from somewhere else. And that was different from some places. For example, in Beijing, the migrants that I spoke with often felt like they were second-class citizens and looked down at by the local population. But in a place like Dongguan, where there's the local population just swamped by the migrants never really felt that. They kind of felt like, well, this is our place. You know, they were, in fact, you know, they realized that they were sort of the heart and soul of the city.
There's a bit that you write about Min when she first arrives there at the beginning, and for a long time, she was alone, her older sister nearby. I wish you could read a bit of that for us, Leslie.
Sure. This is, as you say, from Min's very early days in the city. For a long time, Liu Qinmin was alone. Her older sister worked at a factory in Shenzhen, a booming industrial city an hour away by bus. Her friends from home were scattered at factories up and down China's coast, but Min, as her friends called her, was not in touch with them. It was a matter of pride. Because she didn't like the place she was working, she didn't tell anyone where she was. She simply dropped out of sight. Her factory's name was Karen Electronics. The Hong Kong-owned company made alarm clocks, calculators, and electronic calendars that display the time of day in cities around the world. The factory had looked respectable when Min came for an interview in March of 2003. Tile buildings, a cement yard, a metal accordion gate that folded shut. It wasn't until she was hired that she was allowed inside. Workers slept 12 to a room, in bunks crowded near the toilets. The rooms were dirty, and they smelled bad. The food in the canteen was bad, too. A meal consisted of rice, one meat or vegetable dish, and soup, and the soup was watery. A day on the assembly line stretched from 8 in the morning until midnight, 13 hours on the job, plus 2 breaks for meals, and workers labored every day for weeks on end. Sometimes on a Saturday afternoon, they had no overtime, which was their only break. The workers made 400 yuan a month, the equivalent of $50, and close to double that with overtime, but the pay was often late. The factory employed 1,000 people, mostly women, either teenagers just out from home or married women already past 30. You could judge the quality of the workplace by who was missing. Young women in their 20s, the elite of the factory world. When Min imagined sitting on the assembly line every day for the next 10 years, she was filled with dread. She was 16 years old.
Leslie T. Chang, reading from her new book, Factory Girls, and it is quite a book. What's in the minds? We've got millions and millions and millions of young Chinese women doing this. You've become very intimately familiar with what they're thinking as they do it, how they see themselves, you know, as galley slaves or independent actors, stuck or on their way up. You describe Min there feeling dread at the idea of being there forever, but then she didn't plan to stay there forever.
That's right. Yeah, I think that, you know, one of our preconceptions coming in as Westerners is that these workers must feel incredibly oppressed and traumatized and powerless, because this is how we see their situation. Really, you know, when you talk about a pretty unskilled, uneducated young woman against the machinery of the factory, she doesn't have much power. But that's not how they see their own lives at all. You know, they see themselves as actors, main actors in their own dramas, that everything is up to them. That if they make a good choice or go take a class and learn some skills, that they can actually move up and change their fate. Many workers that I spoke with use this phrase, gai bian ming yun, which means to change your fate. And that's really how they saw their time in the city, that they were going to move into a higher class of people and change their whole future.
You were talking about
it was a very much an active a sense of individual agency among them that was very striking for me coming from outside.
Just before our last break, you were talking about the Confucian backdrop against which that plays out. Does that create then, does that make a break with that Confucian cultural backdrop?
Yeah, it's very interesting because they, as you say, they come from a quite traditional Confucian background in the village, which emphasizes that young women are basically the least valuable, least worthy people in the family. They must obey their elders. Girls, you know, women must obey men. And they're seen as sort of, you know, they can't contribute much to the farm labor. But when they come to the city, it totally changes. And suddenly these young women, someone like Min, she's making, you know, 600, 700 yuan a month, which is, you know, $80 or $90, which doesn't sound like a lot to us. But for her family, that's the first time they've ever seen this much cash in one place. So suddenly she has overturned the power structure in her family and she's sending money home and starting to dictate affairs in her family, you know, telling her parents what to do with the house or how to educate the younger children. And it's really interesting how quickly this changes. But at the same time, you know, I think this freedom and opportunity that migration brings also brings a lot of conflicts because, you know, you're coming from this very traditional world into this very modern one, but you can't just drop everything you grew up with overnight, you know. So I thought the sort of conflicts between the young women and their families, between the modern ideas of the city and the traditional pressures, for example, to get married and have children early, played out in their lives in a quite interesting and moving way.
We'll look at that particularly when they would go home on those rare occasions. We have a lot of listeners with questions for you, Leslie. The new book is Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Robert is on the line from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a long-time caller. And we're only saying these things about China and long hours, but the self-reliance.
Robert, I apologize, but your line is so rough. I'm going to have to summarize. I've got a note here. Leslie, Robert is saying they've got the long hours and the bad conditions, but maybe there's still a Chinese dream in a way like there has been an American dream. Maybe that makes China a natural ally, that kind of ambition moving on up. Do you see a parallel there?
I do. I'm really glad that Robert brought this point up. One of my starting points in reporting this project was, you know, as I mentioned, you know, there were all these very negative stories in the press. And I was thinking, well, you know, coming out from home to a big city and making your way in a new world, that's also the story of America. You know, it's a universal story. It's not just a story specific to China at this time. I do feel like there are parallels. For example, you know, I did a lot of reading of the factory girls of Lowell, Massachusetts in the 19th century and how they came out from their farms to work in the cities. And there were a lot of commonalities in terms of their experiences and their role in the rise of the industrial economy in America then and these workers in China now.
Let's get another question along those lines from Middlesex, Vermont. Anne, you're on the air with Leslie Cheng.
Hi, thank you. I see a parallel even back at the time before the American Revolution, the first few, like a decade or two before, when many workers from rural farms in America started making their own implements, started making their own manufacturers and leaving their farms to go into more populated areas to sell their wares, which actually had been imported from Great Britain before that. So they became more self-sufficient, and this led to them being able to be independent economically of Great Britain. Mm-hmm. Britain. And I'm just wondering if I read about this big, you know, move to similar moves that China is making with its workers leaving and going to big cities, and I'm wondering if a new kind of self-determinism is coming into the minds of these individuals and sparking a sense of wanting to fight for their individual rights, whether it be better working conditions or maybe even starting unions. I don't know. I mean, what extent does China have in controlling that sentiment? And you know, because this is a huge mass of people who are experiencing self self-sufficiently.
Yeah, it's a great line of questioning, Anne, and thank you much for calling in with it. Leslie, what do you say on self-determination, on collective determination, unionizing, the mentality that emerges from the experience of these millions of young women?
Mm-hmm. Definitely, I see a new individualism as, you know, rising in this huge population of people, exactly as Anne mentioned, you know, coming from the collective village, the family, the past into the city where you sort of rewrite your own story and make your future. That's definitely encouraging a sense of individual will that I think is quite revolutionary in Chinese society. At the same time, I don't think this necessarily leads to greater political dissent or demands, because from my experience of talking to these migrants, what motivated them was their very specific individual situations. You know, they wanted to get better wages, they wanted a slightly better job, they wanted to take computer classes so they could rise up and become a secretary or an assistant in an office. So even though this individualism is really developing on a mass scale, that doesn't mean that people are automatically going to be pushing for collective political rights. I think right now they're still very pragmatic and very focused on their individual situations.
And focused on moving on up. One of your chapters is To Die Poor is a Sin. And one of the two you focus on, Chun Ming, you write how she came, started out in a toy factory, almost tricked into a brothel, but just absolutely determined to move ahead in this era of opportunity. We should describe for us how she did that. I mean, even to the point of somebody brought up the early colonial America. She even had a copy of Ben Franklin's 13 Rules of Morality, that kind of up by the bootstraps sense, very strong there. How did this factory girl finally move ahead?
Yeah, she sort of exemplified the American dream in a Chinese form, and that was one of the things I loved about her. Chun Ming came from, as you said, a very poor kind of typical farming family background, and she was just incredibly determined to move up any way she could. In her early years on the factory floor, she studied, as you said, lots of inspirational tracts, things written by Benjamin Franklin, inspirational sayings from Lee Iacocca, all sorts of this bizarre stew of ideas from all around the world, largely American, that she felt like would make her into a more modern, polished professional person who could move off the assembly line. So she had a really up and down path. After the toy factory, as you said, she was almost tricked into working in a brothel as a massage girl. And then she worked her way up in a series of factories. And then she started doing direct sales, which were basically different forms of pyramid schemes, which, again, were tangentially connected to American ideas such as, selling Amway or Avon mm-hmm. products. But in China, they took on this very kind of bizarre cast, and many of them were basically just pyramid schemes. But Chun Ming, being very enterprising, found some of the best pyramid schemes and actually made a lot of money doing this. And then she started a new business and lost all of her money. So, I just was so interested in the dramatic ups and downs in her life. I thought that was very emblematic of China in this age of reform, where things are just very chaotic and up and down, but people are just sort of very energetic and just pushing through and trying to get better.
Her life has a long way to go, one guesses. But with those ups and downs, how did she look back on this whole system, her time as a factory girl? Did she feel justly treated by it or not?
Well, it was interesting talking to her and the other factory girls was that they rarely looked back on their lives and made an assessment of how far they had come. Because most of them, after they'd been in the city for a while, they'd already become sort of someone else. They'd become a more polished person.
Mm-hmm.
City girls, yeah, they listened to, pop music and they dressed just like the city girls. You couldn't really see any difference. So when you talk to them, they didn't say, oh, I've come so far, or oh, I'm so proud of myself, or I've worked so hard and I don't have anything. They were just kind of focused on what was right in front of them and looking towards rising up one step.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking with Leslie T. Chang. She's author of the new book, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China, the women behind the clothes on your back, most everything we buy, the factory girls and how they see the world, the millions and millions of young Chinese women whose sweat equity has made enormous piles of money for China and really is changing the global order of economic standing by their labor. Leslie was for 10 years a reporter in China for the Wall Street Journal. Her husband is Peter Hessler, whose books you may know, Rivertown, 2 Years on the Yangtze, and Oracle Bones, A Journey Between China's Past and Present, great books in themselves. Lynn's calling from Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air with Leslie T. Chang.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to ask Leslie, I had heard a program maybe a couple months ago about factory girls that were in China, and they were manufacturing the beads, the plastic beads for Mardi Gras here in the United States. And there was some interesting psychological effects when the girls learned what the beads were actually being used for. They were taking a lot of pride initially in how they were making them, and they thought they were jewelry, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the mistake was made when someone decided to show them footage of Mardi Gras and how the beads were tossed on the ground, and that, you know, afterwards the cleanup, a lot of these beads were just being disposed of. And I guess my question really has to do with some of the factories that these girls work in. Do they ever question the product that they're putting out, or is it really just the job that they're mostly concerned about in following through with? Because I know that they're really getting a chance in life that they wouldn't have otherwise. But do they ever really look at what they're producing, and do they have opinions about that?
Yeah, Lynn, it's a great question. I've wondered the same thing myself. Leslie, what about it? How do they think about what they're making and where it's going? Mardi Gras beads or Christmas stuff or things that are so particular may have nothing to do with their culture. And I don't know if it's urban legend them seeing a video of Mardi Gras beads on the ground, you know, being walked on. But how do they think about the whole cycle of what they're producing?
Yeah, I actually felt like their relation to the products that they were making was very, weak to non-existent, you know. And my example is when I talked to the different factory girls, they would never tell me what their factory made. It was never an issue. It was never something that was in their minds. You know, what they talked about was how much money they made, how the conditions compared to the other factories, how much they made compared to the other workers. Mm-hmm. As Lynn mentioned, it was really focused on the opportunity, economic or otherwise, that the job brought them. And it would usually take, you know, much later in the conversation, I would say, well, what does your factory make? And they would say something very vague, you know, oh, something with mobile phones. And I'd be like, well, what is it? And they'd be like, oh, I think it's a rubber part that goes in the back of a mobile phone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty clear to me that what they made was sort of irrelevant. You know, what mattered to them was what the job brought them, basically.
What about the consumers on the other end of that transaction? Do they ever think about who's going to buy or use what they're making, who's got the money to buy it, about Americans or otherwise?
You mean, what do the American consumers think?
No, I mean the other way. The factory girls you're writing about, do they think about who's buying what they're making and the kind of lives that they lead, let's say the American purchasers might lead?
Yeah, again, I think it's pretty abstract for them. You know, they know these products are being, you know, worn and used by Americans and Europeans and Japanese and Koreans, but it's not really connected. It's so far removed from their own lives that they don't really spend a lot of time thinking about it.
It's incredible.
One thing that was interesting was I spent a lot of time at the Yuyuan Shoe Factory, mm-hmm. which makes running shoes for Nike, Adidas, Reebok, and most of the big brands.
Right.
And there was one conversation I had with several of the girls in the dorm, and they were saying that they had made some Nike shoe that sold for 6,000 yuan in America, and they were all just sort of like, wow.
6,000 yuan would be how many dollars, roughly?
That's about $700. They said it was some kind of model shoe or some kind of runway thing, and they didn't really know. And afterwards, I asked Nike, and they said, "Oh, we don't know what they're talking about." You know, so I think there were some myths that grew up around the products they were making. But that, you know, I remember that one conversation. In general, I felt like the girls were quite removed from the products of their own labor.
You write in a way about how they're slaves to fashion or the schedule of fashion, the cycle in the year, that their schedules aren't tied anymore to the agrarian life or farming season, but to the hottest sales months in basically Western markets.
That's right. Basically, their lives were lived by the you know, production cycles of the factory. That was something that was really striking when I visited the shoe factory over a number of months. You know, they would, when I first visited, it was June, and that was the beginning of the slow month because the big shoe shopping season in Europe and America had just passed. So a lot of them were going home for a month on leave, or they were sleeping late and having very lazy, relaxed work days. And then, you know, I visit again in August, and already their cycles are changing because the long, slow rush towards Christmas is beginning. And it was just really fascinating to see how their daily lives, you know, what time you have to get up, how late you have to work, whether you have time to go visit your friends. This is all connected to what shoppers in New York and Los Angeles and Boston and Paris are doing. You know, it was just like this very strange illustration of globalization played out in these few individual lives.
Let's go to North Salem, New York, and Sarah. Sarah, you're on the air with Leslie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have two quick questions. One is about language and, you know, all these women coming from, you know, very different in parts of a very vast country. And do dialects or anything like that play a place in their ability to get a job, make friends, get promoted? And my second question is, do some of these young women come to the city to meet a man, get married, and have their one baby? I'll take my answers off the air.
Thank you, Sarah. Leslie Chang, you're right about how for many of them, the first language they have to learn is Cantonese because it's the language of the bosses in this huge factory city.
Yeah, that's actually changing. The story of Chuen Ming coming out from home in the mid-90s, definitely at that time, Cantonese, which is the language of Guangdong province where she was working, was still the dominant dialect, and she struggled to learn it over a couple years, and finally she did. But in recent years, because people are coming from all over the country to Guangdong, now the common language of the factories is Mandarin, which is kind of the official dialect of China. So it's kind of interesting. It's as if, you know, everyone, well, it's hard to draw a parallel. It's as if everyone from all over Europe got together and they had to speak English because that was the only language that they had in common, even if it was their second or their third language. That's kind of similar to how it is in the factory world today. In terms of getting married, yes. One big motivation for the young women in the cities is not only to get a good job and make some money, but to rise to a good station so that you will meet a person who's also of a higher station. I guess it's kind of a, you know, I just realize I'm using this word station. It's kind of an old-fashioned concept to us of, you know, rising from one class to another. But, you know, in China today with this incredible social mobility, there's a very strong awareness of where people fit in. And, you know, a lot of factory girls would tell me, you know, I don't want to get married right now because if I get married, I'll just marry an ordinary factory worker. I want to move up a little bit. And then the person I marry will be of a higher class and our children and their whole future will be changed. And I'm seeing more and more of these migrant workers marrying fellow migrant workers and settling down in the city. In the old days, they would usually spend a few years in the city working, making some money, and then go home to the village to get married and live on the farm. But now, because migration is so prevalent and so common in the cities and no longer seen as this very bizarre, kind of shameful even experience, but a very normal part of life, more and more of these migrants are getting married, renting apartments in the city, and having children there.
And give us a sense of just how big a break that is from the traditional over generations path in many of these hometowns, villages. These are not places of social mobility and have not been for centuries. When they went home, and you went home with them for holidays, you know, what's their reception of these fate-changing, for these fate-breaking, in a way, young women?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I went home with Min, the younger migrant woman I write about for Chinese New Year, to her farming village in central China. And we spent 2 weeks there. And it was amazing because I could sort of see this drama of her life had changed. And here she was encountering her old world again and how she dealt with it. And how she dealt with it was she was incredibly challenging to her parents and very dismissive of many of their ideas. You know, as soon as she walked into this little, you know, two-room house where she'd grown up, she started criticizing all the things, you know, this is dirty and this garbage should be in a plastic bag and don't use these cups because they're not hygienic. You know, she immediately started lecturing her family about how to be cleaner and more civilized. And, you know, she'd only been out in the city a couple years. So this is kind of like how quickly her mindset changes and how quickly her relationship with her family and her traditional village change as well.
What did you conclude this means for China? It sounds like another kind of cultural revolution. That's too loaded a term or moment in history for China, but still, it's, you know, it's such a break with the past. These women are going to have a lot of sway, already do.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a revolution. I think that's a really great description because it's sort of invisible, but when you see it up close, it's really striking. I actually think that, you know, you mentioned the Cultural Revolution. Part of the book is about my own family's history because my grandfather was also born in a farming village. And then he left. He migrated out to go to school and eventually to America and then came back to China. And my family, who stayed behind in China, suffered a lot during the Cultural Revolution. So I was kind of comparing that historical era and this modern era, which I think both are quite revolutionary. And sort of we wouldn't have this past, this present in China today if we didn't have this very traumatic past. You know, I think it's this memory of this traumatic past that makes people today very pragmatic, very determined to improve their lives, to get whatever little bit they can, because I think they know this is kind of an unusual time in China's history.
Willing and ready to turn everything upside down and go for it, because there's the option, the possibility right now. Let's get a call from Boston. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Leslie. Leslie and some of the callers have made the parallels, comparisons between the experience of the Chinese women and the early industrialization in the U.S. and also I just wanted to point out about 20 years ago, there was a film made on PBS called The Global Assembly Line, which focused on the experiences of Mexican women and Filipino women. And, of course, they focused more on, and historically here, more on the negative things. But what also was noticeable was the women leadership that arose to sort of change those situations. And my question is, does she see under a communist government any arising, I guess I'd say, of class consciousness among some of these women to deal with some of the issues, particularly the negative issues that they face in the factories of China?
A collective class consciousness. You've talked about their individual ambition, Leslie, but what about that collective sense? I don't read you finding a lot of it.
Yeah, I didn't feel like that was developing that much. You know, as I mentioned before and as you said, I felt like the individual concerns were foremost. And, you know, I never heard a migrant woman say, you know, it's so unjust how they treat the people from rural China, or it's so terrible how this society looks upon women. You know, there was never the sense that, you know, we're part of a greater group, that if we rise up together, we're going to fight and change the system. It was more just like, you know, I want that job that my friend has because it's better, you know. You know, maybe eventually this will change in China, but I think when you look at the long term, you know, economic reforms in China are only 20 years old, and it's still very new, and people are still experiencing this opportunity for the first time. I think it's quite natural that what they want is to just get a bit more for themselves. And, you know, I think China collectively as a country has had enough of abstract ideology and preaching and talking about, you know, unfairness and injustice and class consciousness. I think, you know, there's sort of a collective unconscious movement not to talk about those big issues and just focus on sort of daily life and improving daily life.
Well, that in the big, big engine of the global economy. Let me get a call from Falmouth, Massachusetts. And Guo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
And I'm a Chinese-American, so I'm very excited to hear this radio program that look inside of China to see how China has gone through so much. And I think it's very important to look in, you know, how the average people has improved and how, you know, the daily life has influenced their lives. And then the focus, you know, how to understand that Chinese involvement and development affect our life, I think it's very important, because I went through the many years when I was in China and go through different stages of life. And it's really amazing to see how fundamentally the society has changed. And I think that's, you know, that's very important for Americans that to hear about this. I think it's, you know, to help us to understand how the change will eventually affect us and affect the whole world.
No question. Well, thank you very much for your call. Our time is short. Leslie, how about it? This population of millions that you've tracked so intimately, you know, as Guo points out, their impact collectively, economically, on the world, on the United States, is great. What does this country meet when it comes eyeball to eyeball finally with these women as their, you know, they and their children's economic power grows?
Yeah, I just, you know, my focus was much more on sort of individual lives. I think for Americans, I just hope that people can understand more what some of the average Chinese people are going through. You know, I feel like the coverage of China in America is often very schizophrenic. You know, one moment China is this amazing superpower, the next minute it's this evil place that's making, you know, poisonous milk formula. There doesn't seem to be any commonality between these two extreme images of China. And then I hope through these stories, these very specific stories of a few individuals, people can understand, well, you know, these are people who are going through very understandable emotions and having the same kind of ambitions and experiences that we in America have or have had, and just have a little more appreciation of what Chinese people are going through.
But having those experiences on a growth curve like we haven't seen here in a long time, they're remarkable stories, and I'm grateful to you, Leslie, for bringing them to us in all their intimacy, for the time you put in and the stories you brought out. The book is Factory Girls. Leslie T. Chang in San Francisco, thank you very much for being with us and sharing some insights on it today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.